Welcome to Turnout Radio, opening up the dance scene on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Hamilton. Thank you for joining us again this Wednesday and every Wednesday to talk about all things dance. And I wanted to start today's show by thanking as well our many, many listeners who've had the opportunity to support this great radio station via our fundraising drive. Thanks to all of you for your many continued years of support. We just love you, our listeners. And you can, of course, be sure to connect with us at CIUT.fm if you have any questions with regards to the station and, of course, at turnoutradio.com for information regarding this show. Now, today on the show, we're going to be speaking about a Black queer body in dance, many representations of art and self. And I am extremely delighted to welcome my guest co-host for today, an individual who is not a stranger to Turnout Radio. Kevin Ormsby joins me now. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Nicole, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's so good to have you. And for those individuals, Kevin, that have not had a chance to be introduced to your brilliance, your passion lies in so many different areas of dance, from the creative practice, arts programming, to advocacy. And of course, many of us know you as the artistic director of Cachet Dance. And you also work with the wonderful Sipamo.
Yes, I do. And used to be a dancer back in the day.
Well, many of us still consider you to be a dancer and a dance leader. So I want to thank you today, Kevin, for joining me on the show as we discuss a Black queer body in dance, many representations of art and self. And today we are going to be welcoming two guests that are going to be joining us shortly. Stay tuned and stay locked in right here on CIUT 89.5 FM. Kevin and I will be right back after this.
CIUT 89.5 Toronto.
Welcome back to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Hamilton, back with Kevin Ormsby. Now, Kevin, today we're going to be speaking about, as mentioned prior to the break, a Black queer body in dance, many representations of art and self. And who do we have joining us today for this conversation? Because I'm so grateful as well that we're going to be taking the full hour of the show to dedicate to our theme. Who do we have joining us today?
Well, we have Raven Wings. Raven is an African Bermudan Mohawk two-spirit queer and transcendent individual. Raven aims to challenge mainstream arts and dance spaces by sharing her stories while continuing to create opportunities and platforms for marginalized LGBTIQQ2S people with a focus on African and Black communities.
And of course, we're also going to be having the wonderful Rodney Diverlis, who is going to be joining us as well. And Rodney is a Haitian-Canadian performance maker, multi-hyphenate artist, and artivist who samples from the realms of contemporary and jazz dance, physical theater, puppetry, and Africanic sensibilities. Now, he uses the body as voice and voice, pardon me, as sites to host movement, text, rhythm, and protest that weave in ancestral diasporic and queered narratives of life and freedom. Really looking forward to sitting down with both of them this morning. Joining us now is Rodney Diverlis. Rodney, welcome to the show.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Great to see you. Great to have you with us as well. And of course, joining us as well, Raven Wings. Welcome to Turnout Radio.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
So this morning, you know, Kevin and I had made mention of the fact that we're going to be speaking in detail about a Black queer body in dance, many representations of art and self, and we had some listeners who had some questions with regards to the theme. We'll if we have time, we'll definitely get to those questions. I'm hoping that we will. But we wanted to open up this morning with regards to, in particular, contextualizing Black bodies. And so we know that the importance of Black lives and anti-Black racism is amplified around the world due to the murder of George Floyd. So for either of you, what does it mean to be a queer Black artist, especially in this time? And actually, Rodney, if we can start with you, please.
Yeah, I think that there's an urgency in living in this body in this moment. And I think that right now, more than ever, I'm feeling a deep sense of there's a lot of power in existing in this Black queer existence, in this Black queer body. And there's a lot of our bodies are sites of power. And I'm feeling more than ever, I'm sitting and grounding in my own power. And my Black queer ancestors are out there rooting for me to fill in myself in the most full way that I can be, and doing it in a way that's fully unapologetic, doing it in a way that's responsive to this moment, and doing it in a way that visibly puts my Blackness and my queerness at the forefront. I think that it's an incredible moment to be living in right now. It's an incredibly profound moment to be living in, and I'm excited at how much community and how much more community we can be building as Black queer artists, movers, and everyone in between.
Mm-hmm. Well said. And Rodney, many would say that there is somewhat of an awakening that's happening in the world. Would you agree with that?
I mean, I think that for many of us, we've already been awakened. I think that there's an awakening that's happening for those who don't experience police violence, anti-Black racism, queer and transphobia on a regular. So I would agree with that. I think it's about time. I think that there are many of us who've been screaming for our lives way before my birth, way before my parents' birth, way before my grandparents' birth. Like, we've been screaming for our lives ancestrally for a long time. And so this awakening, this slow awakening is new for some people. I'd say it's about time. And for many others who haven't been awakened, time's moving. And there's sort of a new world or the old world. And I think that this is a sort of reckoning collectively for us to jump on board to the future.
Well said, Rodney. And Raven, what are your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are very much the same as Rodney's. You know, as artists, I believe it's our duty and our function as storytellers to reflect what is actually happening in real time on the ground. I think Black artists specifically right now are being called to the front lines. If you think of Black Lives Matter Toronto, for example, we are a group of artists and art makers and curators of culture. And so utilizing our understandings of this period of time where people are at home, right? I have a rejection to awakening and more of a space of people are at home sitting on couches and then having to sit with the issues. And so right now, you can't escape what is actively happening, you know? I think it's high time that everyone got involved. I think that we exist in a time period where folks don't know how to join, don't know how to get involved, and also have a fear of what revolutionaries look like. Myself as a Black trans woman felt that way. I didn't feel like I was allowed to represent my communities. I didn't feel like I was the right image to be in front. That's what I believed from, you know, the history of trans folks in cinema and television, right? And so we're taught that revolutionaries were business suits and ties, not black lipstick and heels, right? And so for me, I think it's an important space for us all to be in, understanding that we have to utilize what we're good at. So I'm a storyteller, right? And so my ability to get people to really sit with what is real, what is happening. I think it is an attempt to absolve yourself from the system and the history of anti-Blackness for the past 400 years to say that you weren't aware of it. You were aware of it, you just didn't care. And I think we have to be honest about where we're situated. I think that's okay to say, you know what, I was an immigrant. I came here and I just didn't want to get involved. There are legitimate concerns that people have, but now we're seeing more than ever, especially with COVID, that we're all connected, that we all actually affect each other. And so our liberation is tied in with each other.
You know, you are so on point. And when you make mention, Raven, about especially being in COVID, we've had listeners who have called in and said that it's with respect to this conversation, with respect to anti-Black racism, we are all being forced now to sit and watch what has been happening for generations and generations, but we're now forced to sit down and watch it live on our screens, watch it on our news feeds. And that is no accident. So I thank you for sharing that. I thank you. And for those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Nicole Hamilton, sitting down with my co-host, Kevin Ormsby. Now over to you, Kevin.
Thank you. I wanted to take some moments just to follow up on a couple of things that was mentioned. Rodney, the idea of artivism, which is actually about art and activism, which sometimes we don't hear a lot of in dance. What exactly is involved in this? Because I do hear also the idea of living and creating in this moment. I hear also the idea of representation in diversity as a queer body, as a Black queer body. And so we're actually breaking down a lot of the structures around how body and Black bodies and queerness is perceived through the arts. So I want to thank you for that. And in the idea of embodying and also creating in this particular sense, I'd love if you could talk to me about further around the historical implications of that body and what you might have actually experienced as challenges as a Black queer artist, both of you actually, as Black queer artists that you've heard of or have experienced in your art making.
Ooh, jump right in, Kevin, jump right in. I mean, I think that to be creating art, particularly embodied art, as a movement artist, as artists that host text and movements in our actual body, the art is ourselves, are coming into our art as our full self, automatically, in my opinion, makes you an artivist. Whether or not I'm creating work about blue paint or this white headphone, by sheer nature of my embodied experience as a queer, Black, migrant, Caribbean man in this country, by sheer nature of that, of how politicized, how racialized, how othered, how radicalized that experience is by living here, I think that makes us all artivists. So to me, I think that there is a natural alignment with, it's no surprise that a lot of the folks that are out in the front lines, often pushing for social issues, are artists, are Black, are queer, are trans, are gender nonconforming, are from communities in which our very existence is radicalized, or very existence is site of protest. By existing, by moving in my Black body, I am resisting a white supremacist cultural landscape. By just standing up on stage and being, and literally not doing anything, by just being, I'm fighting against centuries of erasure of our bodies and our art and our work. So I think that there's something about about that transcendence that I find really magical, and that's part of the living in our power that I think is really important in this moment, to recognizing that we are, by nature of us doing the work that we were doing, all of us, all four of us in this call right here and beyond, we are actively pushing for a future that sees us at the center and sees our identities and our experiences at the center. And then to your second question, around being a Black mover or dancer, and contextually right now, I think that this is a moment, this is an opportunity for a reckoning for all of us to evaluate not only ourselves and our being Black and queer and trans and being of a different experience, navigating a white, normative, straight, cis system of art, a system of dance, systems, institutions, etc. I think that there's something about this moment that allows us to openly and bravely critique the structures that we know don't work for us, and the ways that we have to, that our art practice and our art making has to always be radical or against the grain, because the grain doesn't work for us. So I do think that that's also a magical opportunity as well, both to increase and to sort of evolve our own individual art practices, but to also break down and literally take down the structures and the systems that are keeping many of our bodies and our experiences out of the door.
Thank you. That's a really, really beautiful and affirming way to think about art and art making and Blackness and presence and stance and space. Raven, I wanted to go over to you and just, if you're okay with me, querying a little bit more about, you mentioned the idea of like visual representation and what it meant the moment when you stood in your own truth and your own power to at the front. Could you unpack that for me some more? Could you speak some more about, as an artist, as a Black artist, what did that mean for you, but as also a trans person, when that moment became a source of not just power and empowerment, but also the way of moving a conversation about trans artists in space forward?
It's a recognition of history. I think that there was a deliberate attempt to erase Black trans people from history. Black women, Black queer folks, Black gay folks. If you think of Bayard Rustin, who taught Martin Luther King about nonviolence and then was erased from the conversation. If you think of artists like Josephine Baker, Nina Simone, Chaka Khan, these were artists who reflected what was happening, who used their platforms to educate, like politically entertain. I'm from Bermuda, and so I understand that the music of Calypso is revolution music, right? It is activism music. It is oral traditions. And so, you know, for me, coming through the dance community here in Toronto specifically, it was really difficult for me. Really difficult for me to be able to articulate who I was and for that to actually be respected as something that wasn't just about being fierce, that wasn't just about being the new RuPaul for everyone at school. It was so much deeper than that, and it is so much deeper than that. When I heard about Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, people who started the gay, lesbian, queer, and trans rights movement, who were pushed out, right? That's what it reminded me of. So when I was asked to join Black Lives Matter Toronto, I really had to think about what that would mean for me. You know, like here I am understanding that I'm a Black trans woman and I prioritize my safety. You know, as Black folks, we already understand that we are living in a particular kind of white supremacist nightmare, right? And so it was gonna shine even more of a light on who I am and who I was. But I understood it as part of my duty and to weaponize my identity so that it could free up and move space for other queer and trans people who look like me and who also don't look like me. And so it was really important for me to step up and be in front and to understand my place at the table. You know, for trans people broadly, a lot of decisions are made about our life without us ever actually being in the room. And I needed to be in the room. I needed to be at the table rather than on the menu, you know? And so for me, that's what I took it as my call to action. That's what Black Lives Matter Toronto is. It's a call to action. It's a response to, you know, anti-Black racism. It's a love letter to Black people, all Black people, like mad Black people, trans Black people, poor, rich, well-to-do, everyone. And it's a way to understand through trans feminism how we are all, you know, connected.
Thank you so much for that. Toss it over to Nicole. Do you have any follow-up, Nicole?
My follow-up is to hear the words rather than on the menu. That to me is extremely powerful, rather than on the menu, because I think about when I hear you say that, Raven, I think about the many times that we have felt like we are indeed on the menu, that we are looked at as individuals who should not be taken seriously, but rather should be individuals that are for consumption. Really. So to hear rather than on the menu, that is quite powerful for me. I'd also like to know, as we now think about the relationship to queer identity and artistic practice, how would you speak about your Black queer body in dance, theater, and performance arts and practice? What does that look like for you? How would you speak about that in particular? Rodney, if I can go to you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, as I'm developing and as I'm evolving into my queerness, and I think that queerness to me is a broad sort of goalless spectrum in which we evolve within it. It's never stagnant. It's not something that's sort of stationary. To me, as I'm evolving more into my queerness, I do think, even before I was explicitly talking about my queer identity within my Blackness, my art had always reflected that. Had always reflected the sort of that the clash of worlds, the clash of identities, the also the merging of worlds and the merging of identities, the ways that we're caught at the crossroads when we have to talk about either or Black identities or queer identities. I think that if I have to actually reflect on the sort of art that I either was interested in or was dabbling in or was learning or was making, I had always found a way to sort of squeeze in those perspectives in. I do think that there's more and more I think about ways of challenging myself as an artist and putting more at the forefront of the experiences that I know to be true for myself and all my friends as well. What does it mean to, how do we complicate queerness and race when there's a border involved and there's family on three sides of borders, each of which understanding a different cultural reality? How do we complicate queerness and race and thinking in context of gender and thinking about what does it mean for me as a cis dude to be able to navigate, to be able to easily navigate a dance sector? I think that I'm thinking a lot about what does it mean to complicate my queerness and my race in the context of a new sort of world, a 2020 sort of multiracial world that's attempting to erase individuality. I think a lot about the context of my queerness and my Blackness and how they relate to a sort of a social capitalist world that demands for us to shave off everything that's gritty about us to make it, and how much I've had to shave off the gritty parts of myself to be able to navigate particular institutions. So these are all things I think that and that I think really are at the forefront of my mind as I'm thinking about how to evolve into my artistic practice and my queerness. And finding, for me at this stage, it's sort of a lot of people look at artivists and are like, wow, you're so courageous. And yet there's many times that I feel like there are times that I'll shut my mouth about things that I know to be true, that there's our lives are so much more gritty and are so much more filled with tumult and beauty and magic and ups and downs that even our art can't even house and showcase. And I think more than ever, the sort of encouragement that I'm doing to myself and that I want to do for my community is to push us to sort of be able to channel all of those contradictions, all those complications, all of the mess into our work, and being able to get funded to do so and being able to get supported to do so, and it not being seen as fringe radical work, but perhaps the standard for storytelling.
Well said. And, you know, I had a listener who had said that I find that the work of an artivist and myself being, and this comes from Michelle, one of our listeners, that the work of an artivist can be so fatiguing. I'm tired of always having to answer questions, ask questions, march. I want to do this work, but it becomes very fatiguing. What are your thoughts on that, Rodney?
Yeah, I mean, it is 100%. It's so fatiguing. It's exhausting to be talking about our lives, and it's exhausting to sort of to constantly be talking about, yeah, our need to survive and our need to thrive and our need to have life. Like, it's like that. I always, you know, in this moment, we do a lot of media, and I heard you say this as well, Raven, really well, talking about how the sort of pretty much how there are so many other things that I'd rather be talking about, right? There's so many other things that I think that artists that are not within the margins, artists that don't have our active lived experience of being reminded that you're othered every day, it is exhausting to continually be talking about our lives through our work, through our activism, through our art. And then you create the art, and then you have to talk about it afterwards, and you have to answer questions, and you have to sort of hold everyone's guilt or everyone's microaggressions and be available to sort of soothe everyone for your work while you are constantly putting out work. So I think it comes with the territory, unfortunately, but it is definitely 100% exhausting. And I and Raven, I know that you and I have talked about this many times. And it's something that I don't know if if it can ever be explained unless you're actively experiencing it.
And Raven, what are your thoughts on that? Can you share?
Absolutely. You know, there's a saying is to be Black and woke is to be exhausted all the time, because you are very much aware of the ways in which whiteness, when I say whiteness, I mean the culture of white supremacy, the way that it manifests in every aspect of our lives, right? It manifests in the ways in which dance communities around the globe are transphobic, for example. For one example, I don't just have to navigate being a dark-skinned, unfriendly dancer. I also have to navigate being trans, and also being an image that people don't understand. Like, I'm not supposed to exist. And I think that is really what it's about. Like, when Rodney says, when we stand on stage and simply that is the act of activism, by choosing to live, I am offering a political stance. And there is something about that is devastating to me. You know, we're having all these conversations about Black humanity as if whiteness ever had a right to break down our sense of humanity, our spirits, our fights, you know, and as Black queer trans artists, we are standing on the shoulders of folks who have been telling these stories, right? We have a privilege actually to be exhausted in this time period. When, you know, I there's violence all the time, but violence has shifted and changed and it looks different and it's more insidious. You know, if you think about our ancestors and elders who abolished slavery, and what they had to dream about, you know, maybe they weren't even able to dream about being exhausted. They were just dreaming about being free. And so we have a privilege to be exhausted and tired and to do our part to move the ball forward so that the next generation and the next generation has an easier and lighter and more thriving experience as opposed to an experience of survival. And I think that's what art can do. It can reflect hope. It can teach us how to dream. And you think of Octavia Butler and Wild Seed. When we think of, you know, all these amazing storytellers, Toti Amayemi, you know, when we think of, I think that dance has purposefully divorced itself from speaking truth to power. And I think that when you as we as Black people stand together and are not just the one person on stage, our voice is bold and it's scary and uncomfortable. But I've grown past the point where I'm the only one who has to be uncomfortable in the space. That's old stuff. That comes from the history of slavery and being the mammy in the house and having to wipe up and clean up and take care of and raise while being mistreated and degraded and abused and utilized, right? And so this is what I think about as an artist. It's like, it's the only thing I can do to release the pain that I feel inside my actual body. And so by doing that and reflecting story and sharing the different kinds of representations, like I'm a Black trans woman who is not interested in passing, right? Because I understand that it is so much more powerful for me to exist the way that I am, in space the way that I am, accepted and demanding what I deserve. In every space. I think that dance is far behind actually in terms of opening up and self-reflection. I think that there's a lot of, you know, there's this looting that happened with Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream. He didn't mean that you shouldn't see color, right? He meant that you weren't going to be judged by that. And so I think that there has been sort of this weaponizing of Black thought, Black theory, Black bodies, whilst Blackness and Black culture is constantly consumed, regurgitated, appropriated, you know? And so, you know, it's just the duty of the artist to be the hammer, you know?
Ooh. Wow.
I just got chills.
Wow.
Wow.
Wow. I want, can I stay here?
Oh,
I want to stay here because I've known you forever. I'm getting emotional. There's tears running in my eyes. For the listeners out there, I'm going to get very Jamaican right now. There's some things we need to talk up, because in both of those responses, you're literally indicating that being a Black queer artist is not just about dance or theater. It's about the understanding of Blackness and the artists and the generations before who were also queer, who was doing the work that was never associated as such. Can we just stay here for a minute? Because what I'm also hearing in your conversations are some interesting things around institutionalization of dance, dance training, and also perceptions about dance creation as it relates to a Black queer artist. So you have the idea of struggling to be Black in one particular context. And you have also now the context of creating as a Black queer artist. And I would love for us to, if you don't mind, dig into it some more, because I think here we're arriving at the crux of the challenges that I think a lot of artists either coming up or like you, Raven, who started Il Nana Diversity Dance many moons ago, are having within a larger context of Black Canadian arts expressions. So I'll start with you, Rodney, and I'll just ask the question around, what are some of the recognizable things that you as an artist would put into your work beyond a Black queer body that would allow it to be read by someone as a participant, as an audience member, to say, aha, this is not only just Black art and Black dance, but it's also now Black, specifically queer art and dance?
I mean, I think honestly, most of the things that I put in my work actually speak to my experience as a Black queer artist. I think to get to your question, Kevin, the audiences or white presenters or white directors or white curators or white folks that are actually shaping the way that our art is seen for many times just don't know what to do with our art or ourselves. They really just don't. And I think that Raven said it's like, I got chills when Raven says dance has divorced. I don't want to misquote you, Raven, but like dance has divorced itself from speaking truth to power. And to me, I'm like, I got chilled from that, because every Black queer artist, every Black trans artist I know has not divorced their art practice from speaking truth to power, and have actually are continually speaking truth to power in every single work that they do. Even if it's a topic that has nothing to do with Black queerness, I think that it's our audiences, our institutions, our presenters, the spaces that we are, the ways that once we've created the art, the way that it's received, packaged, distributed, produced, often is at the control of white folks who hold the keys to the dance community for many, or who try to hold the keys to the dance community. And as such, then it gets lost in translation when it comes from your heart to then be produced or to then be seen. I think that, yeah, I think that's just, that is right. My first sort of instinct with your question, Kevin, is actually that I actually, you know, like in a lot of my work, I talk about migration without even talking about migration, but that's from my experience sort of crossing two borders, literally going from being displaced for a 7 years period of time in a sort of temporary land and a temporary home, the sort of needing to always move out of schools. Every 2 years, I've switched schools because of migration growing up. So therefore, a lot of my work has a sense of not even basic sort of not being stuck and being landed in one place. Like constantly the movement is changing and evolving, because that's how I sort of see my life. even the basic choreography structure of moving and being displaced is sort of rooted in my experience as a Black queer migrant in that. And so when it's packaged, a reviewer might see it as, oh, wow, like his choreography is always moving. It's never stationary in one place. It's constantly evolving and changing or whatever. But really, that's at the heart of that is sort of me reconciling with being displaced and landless and never stationary in one, et cetera, which is tied to my Blackness and my queerness and my migrantness. Like there's so much symbolism in all of our work. Again, even if I'm making work about this tea, it's because my experience in this world is so politicized. It's every day, it's charged. When I leave my house, all the eyes, when I go to the rehearsals, when you're working with white dancers and white choreographers, not knowing what to do with me or looking, and all of those sort of experiences all tie into my work. And so I think that it's, to me, if everybody else that doesn't is not living in this sort of life in this body, I think it's incumbent on everyone else to sort of pay attention to Black queer artists, Black trans artists, Black gender nonconforming artists, Black migrant artists, like artists that are actually really identifying their lived experience, even though their work might be about red plastic or something random.
Thank you. I think you're also talking about the idea of nuances that exist in work and creative aesthetics that are drawn in or taken out. Because those are what you actually mentioned are the deliberate queer actions of complicating experience, of complicating creation, and of complicating work. Riven, I'd love for you to talk about Il Nana Diversity Dance. I'd love to talk about what went through your minds as you and the others created that company. Because there is, in my mind, as someone who was seeing the growth of it and seeing all the work that's happened across the city, there are not many queer dance companies out there. And so I'm curious to hear, you know, what does it mean also in the experience now about how that work is perceived in the larger community as choreography or reputable work? Not that it really matters, but I know that's also part of the challenge in terms of when we look at the different diversity of, and representation of queerness and queer arts and self. Could you talk some more about that, please?
Absolutely. So Il Nana Diversity Dance Company, I always say this, started in my living room with my husband and my best friend, Cien Lam and Renaud Jean-Pierre. And it was our attempt to just to have fun. The goal wasn't to create a dance company, actually. The goal was to create a space for us where we could just be ourselves. We could try different things. We didn't have to play the image of the person of color on stage. Most of those roles, we were playing animals. Most of those roles, we were playing like little tree stumps in the back. Like we weren't really seen. And being at School of Toronto Dance Theatre, it just really took the art out of me, to be really blunt. And what do I mean by that? I mean, I had meetings with artistic directors and they were saying things like, your choreography looks like a music video. And I said, well, that's great, because that's why I started dancing in the first place. And they were like, it doesn't really look like what we do here. Maybe you should stop doing the African dance and the hip hop and focus more on contemporary dance. You know? And I had this feeling of like, I didn't really understand what that meant. You know, I trained in Philadelphia. I trained in DC, Duke Ellington High School, where we used everything, all of our backgrounds, to make the art that we were putting out. And so here I was in this prestigious institution telling me that I didn't get to be myself. You know, Cyrus Marcus Frere always says, like, I could split myself into all the different pieces of who I am, but that would actually be too painful, you know? So for us, it was just to have fun. And it was after I saw a drag queen, a drag legend, let's say it like that, by the name of Safonda Cox. I saw Safonda Cox perform on stage and it changed my life, actually. It was fun. It was bold. It was sexy. It was beautiful. It was graceful. It was community. It was, I had never seen a live performance that hit me like that. I had seen all these different prestigious dance companies from all over the world. And I was like, they never really hit me. But when I was standing in that room, in that club, watching her perform, ripping one wig off, and there's another wig underneath, and oh, it was amazing. And watching the experience of everyone else in the room, and we all felt like she was performing just for us. You know, we all felt, I felt alive. You know, I felt like this burning sensation, and I was like, why don't we have that at our school? Mm-hmm. Like, this is what we need. We need to learn how to perform. Like, there's a difference between being a student and being an artist. They're not the same thing. And I'm interested in being an artist, you know? And so that's what Ilnana came from. We started in clubs. Ryan G. Hines gave us our first job. Blockarama, we mentioned earlier, Blockarama gave us our first major Pride gig. And it really launched us into the queer and trans community, a community of artists and storytellers who had been telling brilliant, life-changing work that we just weren't seeing because we were in this understanding that the only real art was art that was pedestrian, that was divorced of lyrics, that was divorced of drums and musicality, you know, all those pieces. And so that's what Ilnana was. It was three kids in a living room dancing at night. And then we would choreograph and put out stuff. And then we realized that the community really embraced us in a way that we didn't understand what we were doing. We were just having fun. At that time, I didn't identify as trans. I was like, I'm just gonna put on this wig and put on this dress and wear nothing at all, because I'm gonna do everything I was told I wasn't allowed to do. But then it became less of a costume and more of an understanding of who I actually was. And the fact that I was being celebrated by this entire community for what I was presenting actually helped fuel us pushing Ilnana to the place that it is now. You know, the big shift, I'll say the big shift was in 2010 when the devastation in Haiti took place, and you know, we were asked to perform. And at that time, we had not done any contemporary. We were just doing heels and fun. But I felt like we needed to bring it down. We needed to bring it into a place of sensitivity and less flashy, less super hero. And we were crying on stage, the audience was crying, and we knew that it was something that had to go on. So we created dance programs, professional dance programs, where we could teach people the skills that we had without the white supremacy. We could teach them or just give them the opportunity to be witnessed. Some people just need to be witnessed, and they don't need ballet. They just need someone to be like, I see you. I see what you're presenting, and I'm here for it.
On that note, Raven, I see you, and I hear, and I want to come back to what you're presenting.
Absolutely.
We're going to go to commercial break, so I'll flip it over back to Nicole for a commercial break.
Thank you, Kevin. You know, I'm so grateful for this conversation and for all of us who are seated around the table today to talk about these needed talks. So stay tuned for those of you who are listening, and please do send your thoughts. You can visit us at turnoutradio.com. Send your thoughts to us so that we can make sure that our artists who are with us today can respond where needed. Stay locked in, stay tuned right here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to take a break and be right back after this.
CIUT 89.5, Toronto.
Welcome back to Turnout Radio on CIUT 89.5 FM. That was John Coltrane with Giant Steps. And I'm so pleased again to be welcoming back all of our guests today, including guest host Kevin Ormsby, who is here with me in the house. Welcome back, Kevin. Kevin is going to be staying with us for the next few minutes. And of course, we're also going to be welcoming back guests Rodney Diverlis, as well as Raven Wings. Welcome back, everyone. And so with just a few minutes in the show, I mean, I have to tell you, this is where I feel like Turnout Radio needs to be 6 hours long so that we can, you know, unpack all of what needs to be unpacked. And in fact, I almost wish that it was a 24-hour a day show, because 1 hour, I mean, wouldn't you agree? 1 hour is not enough to have conversations like this.
Agreed.
Most definitely. Most definitely. We haven't even touched on the idea of like popular culture and pimping queerness. Ooh. But that's another conversation.
Well, in that regard, then, you know, I'm hoping to have all of you join me again here on Turnout Radio so that we can continue the conversation. And with just a few minutes left as we continue the talk, specifically around the relationship to queer identity and artistic practice, I'd like to know, and Raven, we'll come to you now. What are some of the challenges with being a Black queer dance artist in Toronto? You've mentioned some of them, but if you can leave a few with us and perhaps even add to that what you feel some of the, I think to, in particular, what individuals have said, we sometimes don't talk about the many beautiful accomplishments of queer Black bodies. So if you can share in both respects what the challenges are, but if you can also talk about the accomplishments and the things that you are just so pleased that you're seeing right now, in whether that's in pop culture, within community, and more.
Yes, absolutely. It's such a big answer that's rolling through my brain on that. The challenge, like one of the major challenges within dance specifically, is that it believes that it is different than Hollywood, and it is not. The same kind of casting politics that happen in cinema and television happen in dance. And the truth is, if you can't tell the Sleeping Beauty narrative, if you don't look like the prince, and if you don't look like Sleeping Beauty, then they don't know what to do with you on stage, right? And because I don't tell any of those stories, because they don't come from me, I am constantly having to navigate spaces. And so I'll be very honest with you, I quit dancing. I left. In 2014, I said, I'm done with trying to push through a system and a scene that didn't want to see me, even though they saw me. I ventured into the world of burlesque. In the world of burlesque, they call me the Black Widow, because my work is a reminder. It's a reminder of everything that's happened to get us to this place. And so for me, that's what I cling to, the Marsha P. Johnsons, the India Moores, the, you know, all of the wonderful artists who have come before me, who have moved us forward in this conversation, where now we're talking about trans safety on live television and newsrooms. I think that is where we are now. And that is largely because of what the queer and trans community of movers and shakers have been doing.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for that, Raven. Thank you. And to you as well, Rodney, what is your share?
I will just echo 100% what Raven has said. I think that Right now, especially in the dance context where I'm in, we are still in an extremely white led dance sector with a lot of folks who really want to have representation, who want their shows to be reflective of 2020, but who are not willing to do the work. So they cast you and then that's about it. So I think really there's a disconnect with how people are seen, how people are perceived, how they're casted, how they're produced, how their bodies are put on stage. And it really brings up a lot of reservations for a lot of us. So for me, what does it mean for my body to be put on stage unclothed? And how does that, if it's asked of me from a white choreographer, what implications does that mean in how my body is seen and shown on stage? That's just one example. So I think generally across the board, there's a big disconnect with the need and wants to have Black queer bodies on stage, but not doing the work to make sure behind the scenes are diverse, not doing the work to make sure the roles are meaty enough, and not doing the work to meet people where they're at. The positive that I see is that many Black queer and trans folks were stepping into our power. We're not actually taking, we're not, as Raven has mentioned, we're taking our careers in our own controls. We're going to the communities that we want to. We're weaving in Vogue and ballroom and West African and burlesque and those forms that we were told were too Black or too urban. We're weaving them into our work, and that's contemporary art in itself. So I think that's really exciting to see, and I can't wait to see more of that.
So I want to do a follow through, which is going to be our closing, I'm assuming, as well. Stories are coming from you today, both of you. And as Raven says, our work as a reminder for those before. What is one advice that you would have both for an artist coming up who's Black and queer in the community?
Make sure that your art feeds you first. If it makes you feel alive, that is actually what we need in this time period to move forward.
Thank you.
You don't need them to do your work, whoever the them is for you. You don't need them to do your work. There's power in community, there's resource in community. And if a door closes to yourself, build your own door somewhere else. And let the elders that have come by support you in building that door.
Beautifully said. Wow. Well, I have to say, you know, I sit here in this conversation with all of you feeling so empowered. And I want to thank each of you for taking the time to join Turnout Radio today. To you, Kevin Ormsby, thank you for being today's guest host. Rodney Diverlis, thank you for sitting down. Raven Wings, it's been such an honor to sit with all of you. Please do continue to visit us, folks, at turnoutradio.com. We want to remind you that there are so many resources as well that we want to be able to share with you. Visit Turnout Radio. We will be sharing some of those on our website as well. And in the meantime, stay tuned and stay locked in right here on Turnout Radio for much more. I'm Nicole Hamilton.
And I'm Kevin Ormsby.
And of course, to you, Rodney and Raven, thank you. Join us again next week. We hope your week finds you turning out to dance.